Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us today, as always. The Avid Reader, here we are, hosted by Wellington Square Bookshop for 10 years now. Last time we spoke with Andy Weir, who's our guest today, was when Artemis came out, which was like 2017. And of course, I bought The Martian back in 2011 off of Kindle for 99 cents. Quite a bargain back then.
And
it was because of the hard science, which we were just talking about. And then when Crown came out with it in 2014, it was on the front shelf of front table of our bookstore. And, you know, I always say this, but the book by its cover thing, you look at any of your covers and it's obvious you're going to be dealing with outer space. So I remember interviewing Andy back when Artemis came out. Again, that was 2017. And then, you know, how it happened, his fans begged him to get it out there on Amazon. The rest is history. Then within a couple of years of Crown, there's Matt Damon on the Red Planet using his waste products to grow potatoes and relying on an old rover to get messages back to Earth and flying to rendezvous in a completely stripped down rocket. And then after you read it, you go, wow, this could actually work, kind of. Right. And then after that, we talked about Artemis. So we have Mars, then we have the moon, and in Project Hail Mary, which will be released in early May by Ballantine, and probably will be another movie before we know it, as may well be Artemis for that matter. Anyway, we go a lot farther away, this time to Tau Ceti and the Cetus, I guess Cetus, constellation, which is kind of like the sun, a little bit smaller mass-wise, only 12 light years from us, our closest G-type star, kind of like Alpha Centauri with the same proton-proton chain. And the reason I'm saying that, if I'm right, is because this is the way the book works.
Yeah.
And what makes it so fascinating, and this book, you know, like your publisher says, he likes this one the best, maybe. What makes it so fascinating, and to be honest, it's going to be such an instant bestseller, is the fact that it contains as much science as fiction, something you don't often see since guys like Andy and I read when we were kids, Bradbury, Theodore Sturgeon, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, especially since he was a polymath, or Robert Heinlein, who actually figures for a paragraph in the novel, pretty much about how spaceships look like spaceships, which is always amazing to me that the V2 kind of looks like Elon Musk's rocket. I never kind of got that. But before I wander too far off, like I always do, let's talk to Andy a bit about Ryland Grace and how he found himself in quite the predicament. So Andy, thanks so much for coming back. It's kind of like a trifecta for us. So
thanks for having me.
Who is this guy?
Well, Ryland Grace, it starts off the book by waking up in a hospital bed with tubes going in and out of him in various spots. He's clearly been in a coma for some amount of time. There are two dead people in similar beds in the room he's in. He has no idea where he is, why he's there, nor does he have any memory of the past. He has complete amnesia. He doesn't even know his name. And bit by bit, he starts to have kind of flashes of memory of who he was and what his life was beforehand. And also, he pretty quickly realizes he's aboard a spaceship. So over time, he figures out, or he remembers enough to remember that this mission is a desperate last chance effort to save all life on Earth. So
There's all kinds of spoilers. So I'll keep away from them. If we get too close, we can always edit it out.
Well, it's your show. You can spoil as much as you want, but you know, maybe throw up a warning.
I won't do it.
Okay.
But I will talk about, well, we talked about the cover briefly, which is really a cool cover. And then, okay, the dedication. No one's going to forget that at first because it's dedicated to John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. First, I'm a huge Beatles fan, and there are a lot of Beatles references in the story. Some are very sneaky Easter eggs. Others are very overt. The most relevant part of it is that he's aboard a spaceship, and his spaceship has four tiny little probes in it that can be sent back to Earth with whatever information he gathers. And those probes just have, are pretty much just entirely fuel with like a little engine in the back and then this little triangular thing up front for navigation and sensing and sensors and whatnot. And they look kind of like beetles, like the bug. They look like, well, a beetle that's like 2.5 feet long, but it looks like that general shape. So the nickname for those little probes are the Beatles, and there are four of them. So each probe has a name. There's John, Paul, George, and Ringo, which is an obvious thing to name four Beatles that you have. But that's only the most overt Beatles reference. There are lots of other little ones.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. It's funny how the bot who wakes him up, you know, asks him what's 2 + 2 and just refuses to allow him any slack until he gives the answers. And I thought that was great. But then when he figures out the cube root of 8, and I don't mean to sound this in a condescending way, but even when you get to that point, there's probably 50 or 60% of the United States population that doesn't know what the cube root of 8 is. So my question to you is,
the normal one,
or maybe I'm wrong. But the point is, when you get to really hard stuff, like figuring out whether a centrifuge could work or using a pendulum or figuring out why he might not be coming towards or leaving the sun by observing things like that, are you kind of like expecting the reader to understand, are you challenging the reader? Are you expecting the reader, like me, to go down the rabbit hole of Google and find out the answers to these questions? Because that's what I do, and it's great.
Great. I'm glad you enjoy it. I put as much scientific accuracy as humanly possible in my books. And I generally am not willing to sacrifice scientific accuracy for plot convenience. So basically, there's a lot of different kinds of readers in my books. There are the hardcore science nerds who like to even go so far as to double check. And so like you, who'll go down a Google rabbit hole. And if that's what you enjoy, then great. There are other people who just who read it and go like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, I don't often see that, who know the science and say, oh, yeah, that sounds about right. And I don't often see that in fiction. That's kind of cool. And then there is a large category of people that I was surprised to learn about back when The Martian came out, of people who aren't really that into the science. And they just kind of skim those sections and they just say, I assume this is all correct. I'm not concerned about it. And at first, when I first realized that there was a large demographic of my readers were doing that, I was like, oh man, it took me a long time to work this out. It should take you a long time to understand it. But no, it's great. What it means is that I have a level of trust with those readers that they just assume the science is accurate, because they've heard from other people that I put accurate science in my books, and they see a bunch of science jargon and they're like, I'm just going to assume that's all accurate. And having the readers trust you at that level is, you can't buy that. That's great. That's golden. If the reader implicitly trusts you with absolutely zero requirement to put suspension of disbelief into it, that's mm-hmm. fantastic. You want that relationship with your reader. So at first I was like, oh, they're skipping over the science. I put a lot of work into it. But then I realized, oh, they're skipping over the science. They just believe me. They trust me. That's great.
Yeah, it's funny because, well, first of all, kind of off the wall, but isn't it nice that when they made The Martian, and with your help, they kind of stuck to it, which they never do in movies.
Yeah, no, they really stuck to it. So I was happy about that.
That was really cool.
The film adaptation of The Martian is fantastic.
And this one's going to be really cool too. And I've read stuff about it, but I'm not going to say it because I don't want.
Well, it's
wrong.
Not a secret.
But
I mean, none of this. Yeah, we have so MGM bought the film rights. We have Ryan Gosling signed on to play the lead, Ryland Grace, which is convenient because they have the same initials. And then we have Phil Lord and Chris Miller set to direct. And we have Drew Goddard working on the screenplay. He's the one who did the adaptation of The Martian. So this is a great team. You never know if a movie's going to get greenlighted. It's always just a fingers crossed situation, but we'll see.
Who's playing Rocky?
Yeah, I don't know. We have some ideas. There's actually a real question about how to do that, right? I don't know how much spoilers you want on your show, but
no, I don't. I mean, no, it's up to you.
Oh,
no,
well,
no, no.
Yeah, So the question is, basically, we were imagining, you know, because Rocky doesn't speak English, and so, but we were imagining that we could have like a computer voice, like translating for him, and then and this would have to be something that Ryland would put together, and so then it would be like, it could be like, you know how navigation systems have, you can have the voice of like Michael Caine giving you your whatever. So we think he might have on his computer like celebrity voices for voice synthesizers, and maybe he'll choose one of those, and we would get that actual celebrity to voice Rocky.
Yeah, it's kind of like Jarvis and Iron Man.
Yeah, exactly.
But the thing about it's really cool about it is that you could add that musical element.
Yeah.
Which you actually put in there, and they're actual notes. So
they're actual notes.
Yeah. So the other thing about it is there was a pivotal person in the book who's really only in there for a moment, and that's Arina Petrova. So
okay.
Why do you talk about, yeah, because she's not really there, but
she's only there in the book. Well, she's the one who made the initial discovery. And basically, and she's not directly in the book. All you ever see of Petrova is an email that she sent. But right. Basically, Irina Petrova is a astronomer who in St. Petersburg, who works at a university, and she was working on something to do with infrared emissions, emissions of distant galaxies in the infrared spectrum. And she spotted using, she was working on equipment that could sense very, very small levels of infrared against background radiation. And she found that there was a line, a very thin line of infrared light kind of being emitted by the sun's north pole and arcing out and going toward Venus. And there were just like a couple of frequencies of infrared light coming from that line. And she got confused by that and verified it. And then she said, okay, what is this thing? What is this line? And so that came to be known as the Petrova line, because she's the one who discovered it. And those frequencies of light came to be known as the Petrova frequencies. It ends up being the core issue in the book, the core challenge in the book that humanity has to deal with, which is actually threatening the solar output itself. And Ryland has aboard his ship something called a Petrovascope, which is, yeah.
Well, since we've been talking about that, we might as well go into, because it's part of the book and not a spoiler, is what astrophages are. And, okay. You know, you're dealing with another element of science that you don't normally deal. Well, yeah, you did in The Martian, but go ahead and talk about that because
Cool. So astrophage, so the principal problem that humanity is having at the moment is that there is an extraterrestrial life form called astrophage, which is basically like mold. It's not intelligent. It's a single-celled organism. And it's basically like mold or algae. But instead of living on planets, it grows on the surface of stars. It grows and lives on stars. And it needs to migrate because stars just have, at the outer layers, stars just have basically hydrogen and helium, and helium's useless, it's inert. So astrophage has to migrate to a nearby planet or something in that solar system to get the other elements it needs for life, like carbon and oxygen, stuff like that. And then it migrates back to the star to continue collecting energy. And that's how its life cycle works. And it also spores out away from the star, like mold does, in search of other stars to, you know, to colonize / infect / whatever. And so it breeds basically the same way that fungus breeds, like spores, or mold breeds with spores. And once it gets on the star, then it's breeding in the same way that algae breeds in the ocean. It's on the surface, it's reproducing with a doubling time, and it's just this naturally evolved life form from somewhere else in the galaxy. Problem is that it is breeding and it's doubling its population, doubling, and that is causing the output of the sun to be reduced. There's so much astrophage now on the sun that not enough light is reaching Earth. and Earth is going, like, in, if this continues, we will reach a point where Earth is not getting enough sunlight to maintain its biosphere, and everyone and everything will die. And so something has to be done. Scientists realize also that all the nearby stars in our neighborhood are also dimming. So they're also losing luminance because they are also all have astrophage on them. And all of them except Tau Ceti. For some reason that they don't understand, Tau Ceti is not dimming at all. Tau Ceti seems to be completely immune to astrophage. And they want to understand why. And so as this last-ditch desperate effort, they send an interstellar craft using astrophage as fuel, because astrophage stores energy at an incredible ability to store energy. And it itself is like a little spaceship. It migrates from a star to a planet and back. They send an astrophage-powered ship to Tau Ceti to try to find out why Tau Ceti is not affected by astrophage. And maybe it's something they can do to save our sun.
And the thing is that in order to save everybody from astrophage, they have to use it as the fuel that's able to power the ship to go almost as fast as light speed to make the journey in time to save humanity.
Right. Making an interstellar ship. They basically make an interstellar ship with today's technology. It takes place modern day. And the only thing they have that we don't have here in the real world is astrophage. But astrophage is a very simple monocellular life form that can store enough energy for it to propel itself interstellar distances. So they just get a whole bunch of that and use that to propel a ship interstellar distances.
It's so funny because there were two things that remind me of what's going on now with Bitcoin using as much electricity as Argentina. They change it to a different country every day. But
right.
I felt really bad for the scientist who had to go against his entire ethos.
The French climatologist.
He had to increase global warming. I felt really bad for him. He was crying.
Yeah, there's a scientist in there. He's French. I have forgotten the name I gave him. He's also, like Petrova, he's only in like one scene or two scenes maybe. And he is tasked with finding a way to prolong Earth's biosphere. And so he's a climatologist. He spent his entire life working on, you know, global warming and climate change models. He's, of course, an environmentalist. He's very, you know, keenly aware of global climate change and has spent his whole life working to try to combat it. And now he's been tasked with finding a way to prolong, you know, how long Earth can survive with a reduced solar output. And he says, well, the best way to do that would be to increase the greenhouse effect so that Earth retains more of the energy that's hitting it. And so he's in charge of this monumental operation to dramatically increase greenhouse gases. And it just goes against everything he's ever done his whole life. And he's in tears because of it. But it has to be done.
The other thing that really would not be done and destroys the ecology of Earth is when you find the embezzler / negligent homicide or murderer who decides
negligence, not deliberate murderer.
Well, I like them, especially when he does that fist bump at the end. He's like, yes.
Yes. That would be the New Zealander, Bob Riddell is that character's name. And he invented he had spent most of his career working on solar energy stations that actually, these exist in real life, that just reflect sunlight up to a tower that has some medium in it that'll boil and run a turbine. And so it's that sort of solar power. And he had wanted to kind of get those towers built in North Africa, like in the Sahara, where there's like tons of sunlight. But he ran into, you know, they always ran into a lot of problems with local governments and stuff like that. And also he was from New Zealand. This was a thing that was funded by the New Zealand government. and he had a severe gambling addiction. And so he was embezzling money from that. And he was off in Monaco gambling most of the time when he should have been running the place. And then there was an accident at the facility that he was running and people died. And so he was put in jail for negligent homicide. But he then also figures out a way to basically modify the technology he'd come up with for these solar plants to rapidly breed astrophage and to mass produce these things at a monumental scale. Basically, the world's really working together on this one. And so he makes this very simple astrophage breeding farm kind of thing that can be made out of very common elements and just needs to be put out in the sun. The problem is,
yes,
you need to basically pave the Sahara Desert with these things to make enough astrophage for the trip. And so pretty much the entire, you know, and the way they do that is by having the entire nation of China, most of their industrial output is manufacturing these things.
Yeah, like, the funny thing is, if you look it up, those panels are actually kind of being made now using anodizing, because it's much more efficient than painting panels black. So you're kind of borrowing from, as you do, and you said it's set in the current time, you're actually borrowing after technology that's kind of on its way there right now, right?
Sure. And it's actually, well, it's once again, all this stuff becomes fairly easy because of the way astrophage is. So, you know, the alien life form that can collect energy and store it as mass, is that right there is a game changer for all sorts of technology.
I know, when you stick in E equals MC squared, just that one time.
Yeah, just that one, just that little 9 × 10⁻⁶ multiplier can matter a lot.
No pun intended.
Hey, matter.
So that's the other thing, I went down the rabbit hole, because the ambient temperature of astrophage is 96.415, and it has to stay that way, which is like 205.5 degrees Fahrenheit, almost the boiling point of water. So then I thought, I wonder if Andy thought of that number for a specific reason. So then I looked and looked, but I couldn't find anything that really connected 96.415 to anything. So was it arbitrary?
It was largely arbitrary. I thought there was a reason.
You would
well
know.
It has to be it yeah I came up it's the first thing I came up with for the book, so it's been a while. It had to be below the boiling point of water, because at its core, astrophage is a life form that does actually require liquid water inside. And it also I must have come up with it arbitrarily.
That's another paradox in the book too, is Ryland publishes this paper that life does not require water, and then he's denigrated and goes to teach these middle school kids, which he's great at, but he opts out of any more science because he's a pariah, like. But then he's drawn back in by Dr. Stratt.
Well, she's not a doctor.
Oh,
she's
yeah,
an
right.
administrator.
She's
yeah.
She's a but bitch.
She's awesome. She's, yeah. She's,
I love her.
Yeah, she is... her core defining characteristic is no bullshit ever, like just brutally honest, and also not interested in anything that slows down the project. She's in charge of making this ship and making it happen and making this project happen. And she's very acutely aware that literally all of humanity rests on getting this done. And so there's nothing more important than this, and she's willing to sacrifice anything.
It's actually the opposite of in a movie where the guy's holding the gun to the girl's head, and he says, if you don't drop the gun, I'm going to kill her.
Yeah.
She doesn't care.
Wouldn't care. She'd be like, kill her. I got a world to take care of here. She wouldn't think twice on that.
And I won't give this one away, but yeah, she talk about reaming people out when Ryland has a decision to make and he comes down the wrong end of it.
She tears him a new one, and
yeah, and then
makes him
poor guy,
and then compels him to. She is not interested in people's feelings. She's not interested in, she's not even interested in any individual group's well-being. She's just like, this is it, she, her philosophy is simple. If I fail at what I'm doing, humanity will end. Yeah. So whatever it takes.
Yeah, she's what is needed, but she isn't someone you really would want to.
You wouldn't really want to hang out with her.
I was going to say hang out at a bar with her, but there was one moment where she kind of lets down her.
Yeah.
One moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so she's just, yeah, she's a little softer for like when she comes to explain something to Ryland at one point.
That one time.
Yeah.
Since you're talking, you know, you have an international cast, which is really nice. So let's talk about, without getting into the details, because they have really good personalities, Ryland's crewmates on this mission. Because they have different personalities, completely different personalities.
Well, the whole book is, I mean, I really wanted to convey that this was a global effort. It's pretty common in movies and TV shows for, you know, the world to be in peril and America to save it. But like, this is a problem that that manifests itself, and then it takes them something like between 5 and 10 years to build the ship to deal with it. So it's not like the other countries would just be sitting around doing nothing. I mean, everybody's working on it. Everybody's researching it. So it's like, oh, we just heard from these Russian scientists. They found out this about it. Oh, great. Okay. Oh, and the Argentinians found out this and that and the other thing. The crew of the ship was Captain Yao, or Commander Yao, who's from China, a Chinese astronaut, Ilyukina, who was a Russian Federation astronaut, and Grace, but the other two didn't survive the trip. They had to be put in comas for the trip because it would take them, well, this is where relativity comes into it. From Earth's point of view, it'll take them about 13 years to reach Tau Ceti. From the ship's point of view, for people aboard the ship, it'll be about 4 years because they're traveling near the speed of light. So time dilation happens, but still 4 years in a confined area. They basically, they had to be put into medically induced comas, and two of them did not survive that process. Only Ryland did.
I like the way Yao is just straightforward, not dour.
Oh, personality wise, Yao is all business. Yeah. Yao is just, he's extremely professional, acutely aware of the importance of the mission, and just kind of not, yeah, I mean, he's kind of humorless, I guess. He's very, very serious. And then
he has a really good moral code too.
Oh yeah.
There's that one point. Yeah.
There's that one point where he's, yeah. There's one point where he says, this is a suicide mission. And he says, I'm not going to take anybody. He is going to die, and he knows it. And so is Ilyukina, and she knows it. And he says, like, I will not have anybody on this mission, you know, against their will or anything like that. This has to be a volunteer suicide mission. I won't accept anything else. And then Ilyukina is I don't know how to describe her. She's very casual and funny and kind of a smart ass. And like, among other things, they each get to choose. Because it's a suicide mission, each crew member gets to decide, like, how do you want to die? Once your mission's over, how do you want to die? And Yao just says, like, oh, I want a gun. I'll just shoot myself in the head. That's quick and no problem. Ilyukina says, I want a bunch of heroin. And they're like, what? She's like, yeah, heroin addicts seem to have a really good time for a while. I want to experience that. I've spent my whole life being a good girl, never doing any fun stuff like that. So I want heroin, and I'm going to like take heroin until it's not fun anymore, or until I built up too much of a tolerance. And then I'll just deliberately die of an overdose, or Yao can shoot me, whatever. I don't care.
And the other good thing about her is that she leaves vodka. Which really helps out from time.
Vodka, yeah. She also, like, her personal stuff, she has vodka, which, yeah. So she has vodka. She's Russian.
And it's funny, too, talking about drinking, but also eating and sleeping. You create taboos that don't exist here. but and I've read other science fiction books. Yeah, talk about that a little. Well, if you want to go to there.
There is, yeah, they, I will talk about it if you want. There's no way to talk about it without spoilers. So it's up to you.
Right. That's true. Well, he meets someone.
Yeah, I mean, he meets someone out there. He meets an alien. Okay. It's an alien. It's an intelligent alien. And the intelligent alien has, you know, that's actually the bulk of the book is the story of friendship, is what it really is about. And this alien, which he nicknames Rocky, has his own moral codes and ethics and stuff. And one thing is in its culture, you eat in private. It's like eating to them is kind of like pooping is to us. It's like you do it by yourself in a room where no one can see you. It's a necessary biological function, but it's not a social event. it's like something you do entirely on your own. And it's
it's kind of discuss. Gross.
It's gross.
Remember that short story, maybe it was a novella called Enemy Mine?
I remember the movie.
Yeah, where they, oh yeah, I forgot who was in it, where they were, they would,
Dennis
they were,
Quaid?
Yeah, they were enemies, but in that.
But and then they had to work together, yeah.
Yeah, it's right. Kind of reminded me a little bit of that.
Interesting, yeah. Although in this case, these two start off cooperative right away.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
Basically, Rocky is an alien from the 40 Eridani system, which is another star in our local neighborhood, and it is having the same problem. Their star is dimming, and the life on their planet is threatened, and they also come to the same conclusion. They notice that Tau Ceti is not dimming, but all the other stars are, so they did the same thing. They sent a ship.
How did you come up with, I mean, I see some of the names, and I can get where they came from, but how'd you come up with the name Adrian?
Adrian, so Ryland had nicknamed Rocky because Rocky is basically a five-legged spider about the size of a Labrador with kind of rocky protrusions on his exoskeleton. And so that he looks like he's made of rocks. So he's Rocky. That's his nickname. And the two of them together discover a planet that's very important to the story. And they it's Rocky who discovered the planet first. And Ryland said, well, you got to name it. And Rocky says, I don't know what to name it. Because he thinks it's dumb to name everything. He thinks it's dumb that Ryland's ship has a name. It's like, I don't care. It's the planet. We're not going to get confused. And he's like, no, you discovered it. So you got to name it. And he's like, okay. And he has Rocky's race or hermaphrodites, but they're also kind of monogamous. And so he has a mate back home. Whose name is like, you know, it's because they speak in sort of whale song. And he said, well, I'll name it this. And Ryland says like, well, I need something I can call it. He's like, what is that? And Rocky says, well, that's the name of my mate back home. And he's like, well, then we'll call it Planet Adrian, because in the movie Rocky, his wife is named Adrian.
Right. That was good. I wanted you to say that. I like the way Rocky goes. Would you name your chair?
Yeah, yeah. He asks, at one point, Ryland says, what's the name of your ship? And Rocky's like, what do you mean? He's like, well, my ship, it's named the Hail Mary. Rocky's like, you named your ship? It has a name? And he's like, yeah. He's like, that's stupid. He's like, no, it's not. It's normal. And Rocky's like, okay, what's the name of that chair? He's like, well, that chair doesn't have a name. He's like, then why does your ship have a name?
<It's> like, I love when they discover sarcasm, because then you can say human stupid.
Yeah,
human lazy.
Human lazy,
and
yeah.
Also the way he says thank and question.
Yeah, oh, they get a rudimentary language going together, a pidgin, something like that. And Rocky will always end any question with the word question. And also to emphasize something, he'll just say it three times.
Happy, happy, happy.
Happy, happy, happy. Yeah.
Sad, sad, sad.
Sad, 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 sad.
The other,
bad, bad, bad.
The other thing is, very bad. The other thing that's cool is like that one paragraph, which really got to me, because it has, you know, this nose cone shaped nose cone. Yeah. And it says like right out of a Heinlein novel.
Right.
And I realized, yeah, and every cover of whether it's Farnham's Freehold or Methuselah's children, whatever it is, you know, you still see that same shape. And why is it still the same shape since 1945? I don't get it. What if women made rockets? Would they be flying saucers? I mean, it's like a phallic thing.
It's, well, it's because real rockets look that way to cut through the atmosphere. I mean, and it is efficient. And the Hail Mary looks that way because it goes so fast on its transition interstellarly, it's going nearly the speed of light, that the small amount of rogue atoms out in the interstellar medium, there's like one hydrogen atom per cubic meter or something like that, would actually provide a little bit of wind resistance at the velocity you're going. And so it is made to be somewhat streamlined. Even
it's so good that Rocky's a mechanic, because I like when, first of all, it's funny that you talk about hex bolts, because everyone knows what a hex bolt is. And it's just so funny to imagine that he has to take a wrench, undo hex bolts, loses one. And then Rocky goes, I make new one.
I make new one. It's good.
Yeah, that was really, oh, and the other thing is you were saying about either hydrogen being useless because it's inert or argon, but then you have xenon, which is another noble gas.
Right.
And all kinds, I mean, it's so important, but how come it's so useful? How'd you come up with that?
I just wanted, so Rocky's race, whatever, his people have invented a material that is like incredibly strong. It has a tensile strength far beyond anything humans have ever invented. It's like way stronger than carbon fiber, way stronger than Kevlar, way stronger than anything. And so naturally Ryland was curious what it's made of. And so he scanned it with, like, you know, a spectroscopy, which will tell you the atoms that are there. And it turns out that one of the primary ingredients is xenon. And that makes no sense, because xenon is a noble gas and doesn't react with anything. So how can there be xenon in these molecules that make up this material? And he never gets an answer to that. But in my mind, what I was imagining was, this is a material whose strength comes from how stable xenon atoms are. Like, one way or another, somehow it's taking advantage of how much xenon atoms want to stay the way they are to derive its strength, but I never bothered to explain it. So he calls it xenonite, and that's the name that it sticks with it.
Yeah, he gets to name a lot of things.
Yep.
The other thing is, as you did in The Martian, not so much in Artemis, but in The Martian, there's failures. Things that seem like they're gonna work really, really great, mm-hmm. then there's failures. And what's so cool about that is that's actually what happens all the time.
Yep. You know, that's real science.
You know, like in MacGyver, nothing fails. His Swiss Army knife does what it does.
Right.
But in this case, enclosures and other things and contamination actually happen. So just like Matt Damon, he has all these potatoes and then all of a sudden he doesn't have them anymore.
Well, also one major difference is I really didn't want to repeat beats from The Martian. I really didn't want it to be too similar. So Ryland's equipment all works correctly. He's got plenty of food. He doesn't have to do this. He's not out there to save himself. He's out there to save humanity. So the things that go wrong are things related to coming up with those solutions, you know, or ideas.
The other thing is that, and I didn't spoil this, your publisher did, because he says it on the front page of my proof, is that the end is very moving. And it really is. And you know what? I didn't think that was going to be his choice. So I love endings that, you know, the reader's expecting something. I expected something very, very specific. I did not get that.
I'm getting a lot of interesting feedback from the ending. A lot of people are like, I love the ending. Other people are like, oh, I wanted a different ending. So I think some people wanted the predictable ending, but other people really liked the ending that it got. But for what it's worth, I had that ending in mind very early on. So when I was writing the first act, I was still like, okay, I know where this ends. Not sure how to get there yet, but this is how it ends.
And a funny thing is, it kind of was presaged by the fact of the opening scene where he's in a classroom teaching middle school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I like the way that, what was the girl who was kind of a nasty girl in the classroom and said, how do you determine the radius of the earth? And she goes, ask him.
Who here can tell me the radius of earth? And she says, Tran. Yeah, I think, I forgot, Abby. Abby is
yeah, Abby.
And eager girl, and they're all 12 and 13 year olds, whatever, they're junior high students, and he's a science teacher, and Abby's a, you know, smart aleck, she's just the smart kid. She's like kind of the smartest kid, and one of those really, really wants to, just eager to answer every question, and he gives out little prizes and stuff for answering questions in the lightning round. And he asks something, I forget, he asks like, what's the speed of light or something? And she starts saying like, oh, it's 3 × 10⁻⁷, and someone else says, C. And he's like, that's correct, that's more correct. He answered the correct answer first. And then at one point he says, who here can tell me the diameter of Earth? And then a kid named Tran says, oh, it's, 6,000, or what's the radius of Earth? And he goes like, oh, it's 8,000, something like that. And Abby says, Tran, the answer is Tran. And he's like, what? And she says, your question was, who here can tell me the radius of Earth? Tran is able to tell you that. So I've answered the question correctly first.
It reminds me of when I was in law school and taking criminal law, and everyone studied so hard for the exam. And the only question was, why do we punish crime? Huh. And one kid, it was a law, I wrote like 10 pages. And one kid wrote, we don't punish crime, we punish criminals. Ah. And he got an A.
Oh, that's cool.
It's took a lot of balls to do that.
Yeah, ballsy. Or what is it, reminds me of, a professor. There are these four guys who are all in the same class, and they decide we don't really have any chance at passing the final. They go drink. They have a bender, and they miss the final. And so they go to their they come up with a story. They say, oh, we were driving and we got a flat tire and we weren't able to get to the final. And the professor says, okay, all right, well, I'll have to write a new final for you guys because the other students will have told you the questions that are on that final. So I'll give you guys a new final and come back tomorrow, and you'll all have to take it at the same time, because obviously I can't let you guys tell each other the questions. So I'm gonna put you all in different rooms and you'll take it at the same time, fine. And they all get there, they go to their separate rooms and they get their finals. And it says, there's just one question. It says like, question one, worth 100 points, which tire?
Oh, that's great. Well, it's like the prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah, well, no, which tire went flat? It's not even a prisoner's dilemma. It's just they didn't coordinate that.
That's a good one. I'll have to remember that when I lecture somebody. Yeah. That's a good opening story for some type of self-help.
The one thing I learned from a lawyer, the only cool lawyer thing, I'm sure you already know all about this, but the thing is, like, when being deposed, only answer the question, provide no additional information, and something like that. So if I say, hey, do you know what time it is? The answer is yes.
Yes. There are two questions that a lawyer can ask that elicit an enormous amount of information. And my son told me this. The first question is, be more specific.
Uh-huh.
And the second question is, how so?
How so? Yeah.
And it gets everybody who has an ego. They want to tell you more.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's like that. It's like that PhD candidate who was before his three committee men, and basically they asked him one question: why is the sky blue? And
he answered, because.
And then whenever he answered, they would say, "Be more specific." And eventually, they distilled all the information, that all the knowledge that he had in his brain after that one question. Well,
it sounds like a very annoying PhD group.
go on forever training war stories, but suffice it to say, the cool thing about your books is not that there might not be, but they all, when they're done, you know what happened. And granted, sometimes it's nice for the reader to say, I wonder what's going to happen. But it's also nice when you have a, for want of a better word, action-packed book to know at the end, okay, this is where we are.
Here's the conclusion.
What happened. Yeah. Yeah. I like that you do that.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't like leaving things as an exercise to the reader. Whenever I read something and it leaves something mysterious and it's up to you to decide, I'm like, screw you. You're the writer. You're supposed to do that for me. Okay? Don't make me write your story.
Yeah, there's two sides of that one too. You get different readers who say different things.
Don't give me
that.
This lady or the tiger bullshit. Give me an answer.
Which door?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing, is the reason why I like running a bookstore so much is because, and I've said this many times before, I have library ladders, which was like a dream of mine all my life.
Slide it along.
Oh, it's so cool. And especially with little kids, and you can do that. But whenever you're looking for a book, you climb up on the ladder, there's the book, but there's also a book on either side of it. And if you're a kid, you know, that could be the book, you know? It's not like an Amazon recommendation.
Yeah, right. It's the book that's like alphabetically after it, or however you've organized your own personal library.
Correct. Although now the thing is now, which is really stupid and really irritates me, is people organize their books by color. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it. I figure it's a matter of personal choice. It's like, for the most part, books are almost like trophies. I know there are people who like to read the same book over and over again, but even those people, they probably have like this small collection of 10 or fewer books that they like to read over and over again. The rest of their books are things they read once and then just put on a shelf. So books are, for a lot of people, they're just like, I read that, and you don't want to throw it away because that feels wrong. You hang on to it, maybe you want to lend it to people, but it's really just, a bookshelf is almost like a trophy case of like, these are things I've experienced.
Yeah.
And can recommend and so on. And so if you want to organize them by color, so it looks pretty, why not? If someone says like, oh, I want this one book. Do you have it? And you know, you maybe go online and look up what color the cover is, so you know where to find it on your shelf.
Yeah. If you have a range. I'm like you. I have a love hate. Even though I sell books, I have a love hate relationship with either reading it on my iPad that we're talking on.
Oh yeah, I got to be physical. I need physical copies.
Yeah, and luckily, so do many people. Otherwise, independent bookstores have it bad enough with this, with COVID, that people say, "I'd like to." Basically, they think they're holding you in their hand.
Aw.
For good or for bad.
Yeah. I'm almost 50. So I'm a generation that grew up reading physical books, and I don't like reading on digital. I don't know why. It's just a matter of what I'm used to, but I suspect that it will just trend more and more toward reading. Although there was a big panic about that early on. We're like, oh, God, the entire print market's going to go away. And then it just kind of found a medium and stayed there. It's like
you know what I always say, it's like candles. No one needs candles for anything. If the power goes off, you have a headband, all kinds of mag lights. But everyone, I have candles in the store. It's our biggest seller. I have no idea why.
Yeah.
Everybody loves candles.
Yeah. I just hope that books don't go. I mean, a lot of people were using the analogy of like newspapers, but I guess it's not the same. Because newspapers, honestly, I think within a generation or two, they're just not gonna be a thing anymore.
When's the last time you read one?
Can't even remember. Last time I was like at an elderly relative's house. And so it's just like, you know, I get all my news from online sources, but I read all my books as physical paper. Am I that weird generation that's going to be the only one who does that? Or is it going to just stay that way? I don't know. We'll find out.
I don't know. I always thought I'd be ahead of the curve on everything, and I'm not ahead of the curve anymore.
You reach a point where you're like, to hell with technology. I know what I like, and I'm just going to keep doing that.
Well, luckily, you're always getting exercise. You're getting, yeah, you know, like you said, you're always researching, you're writing it down, you put it in Excel. So yeah. All this stuff is not only stuff you already know, but it's an amazing learning process.
Yeah.
And I see with your events that you have, you know, Arcady, Martine, who I'm going to be interviewing on her second book of the trilogy. You're interviewing some, not like me, but some really smart people. So has anyone second guessed anything you wrote and said,
oh, sure.
No?
I mean, all the time. Well, in just emails and stuff all the time, but in interviews, it'll come up once in a while. Sure. And I bring it on myself, and I got no complaints about it. Basically, I make books, I put them out there, and I say, this book is scientifically accurate. By saying that, I am bringing it on. I'm saying, tell me where it's not, because then there's always mistakes. I always make mistakes in some of the books, you know, sometimes deliberate, like dust storms on Mars are not strong enough to knock over spaceships.
All they did, but Perseverance just caught a dust devil on Mars.
Right. But the,
I know.
In, right. And so that one was deliberate. And then there are other places where I made just simple math errors and stuff like that. And people will point it out. And I don't get to complain about nitpicking, because I go into this by telling people that I'm like super duper accurate. So I claimed that that all the details work. So I bring it on myself. I can't complain.
Well, that's what Grace did when he called all those other scientists idiots.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the end, it turns out, by the way, all the life in Project Hail Mary requires water.
I know. That's what was so good about this.
Yeah, he was wrong. He was genuinely wrong.
Okay, well, I can't wait for it to come out as a movie. And Ryan Gosling, I think, is perfect for it. I'm sure.
Right. I mean, he's got the same initials. What more can you ask for?
Correct. So thanks again for being with us. And hopefully it won't be 4 or 5 years before the next one. And I look forward to
it. I do tend
to
write slow.
Well, write faster.
Yeah, I'll try. All right, okay. Man. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.